Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast from the BBC World Service, bringing you extraordinary personal stories from around the globe. Search for Lives Less Ordinary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Friday the 10th of May, these are our main stories. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says his country can stand alone after the US paused the delivery of bombs that could be used in a major assault on Rafah. The Israeli contestant in the Eurovision Song Contest has qualified for the grand final in Sweden despite large protests against Israel's participation. Ukraine's President Zelensky has sacked the head of the guards responsible for his personal protection after an alleged assassination plot. Also in this podcast, China's economy has been slow to bounce back from the coronavirus pandemic, but despite the gloom, one sector is improving.
Tourist numbers lately are not too bad.
Business is going well, and it will only get better.
Domestic tourism. We will stand alone and fight with our fingernails. The defiant words of the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu after President Biden said the US would stop shipments of certain weapons if Israel presses ahead with a full-scale attack on Rafah in the south of Gaza, where more than a million displaced Palestinians have sought refuge. For weeks now, America has said such an assault would lead to many more civilian deaths. But Israel is adamant an attack is the only way to destroy Hamas and secure the release of more than 100 hostages. Mr. Netanyahu released this video statement.
We are determined and we are united towards defeating our enemies and those who seek to harm us. If we ought to stand alone, we shall. I already told you, we shall fight with our fingernails, but we have much more than fingernails, and with the same mental strength, with God's help, together we will win.
While the relationship between America and Israel is suffering one of its most significant ruptures for a generation, people in Rafah are continuing to flee as Israeli tanks move close to built-up areas and the Israeli bombardment continues. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees says 80,000 people have left the area since Monday when Israel warned Palestinians to evacuate. I got more on that with our security correspondent Frank Gardner, who's in Jerusalem. But first, he told me about the Israeli response to President Biden's announcement.
A lot of people in Israel, right across the political spectrum, are really stung and shocked by this. Not since 1982 has the US, Israel's closest benefactor, withheld weapons or threatened to withhold weapons. And at the moment, the US is doing both. It's paused the delivery of some of the most lethal weaponry in its supply chain, the 2,000-pound bomb, that's 906 kilos, because a weapon like that, if dropped on even on a precise target, is going to crush the lungs of somebody 300 metres away with a pressure wave. You just can't use that sort of weapon safely in a built-up area as overcrowded as Rafah. That's why the US has withheld it. So Mr. Netanyahu's video message is really a reaction to this. It's an unrealistic and rather sort of grandiloquent speech, saying if necessary, we'll do it alone. We fought on our own with an arms embargo in our War of Independence 76 years ago. These are different times, and there is no possible way that Israel could survive with all the enemies it's got without US weaponry. It could survive without British weaponry because it's tiny, but the US sends billions of dollars of weapons. Now, I think there is a difference between the US attitude to defending Israel against threats like Iran or Hezbollah, external enemies like that, and the way it's behaving in Gaza, where the US is deeply disapproving of the conduct of the war there, and it's got real concerns that the laws of war could well have been broken in the conduct of the war there.
So does it look to you like Israel is going ahead with an all-out assault on Rafah?
It's certainly showing signs of expanding and intensifying its operation there. What began as a very limited operation in eastern Rafah, preceded by the dropping of leaflets to 100,000 people to move, and as we just heard there, most of them did. But there are reports now coming of shell fire and artillery strikes, airstrikes in other parts of Rafah, and people have been coming to hospitals reporting injuries from there. So there's no question Hamas is there. Israel is convinced that it's got four remaining battalions above and below ground, and quite possibly Yahya Sinwar, the architect of the October the 7th massacre, is there. But this is going to cause a lot of civilian casualties if it gets bigger, and that's the US fear.
Frank Gardner in Jerusalem. To the Swedish city of Malmö now, where the Eurovision Song Contest is taking place. The second semi-final was held on Thursday evening. Israel's entry was performed by Eden Golan, and it was among those that qualified for the final on Saturday. This despite thousands of people taking part in pro-Palestinian protests on the streets against Israel's participation in the contest. The environmental protester Greta Thunberg was among the crowds that gathered in the city's main square, waving flags and chanting. And Eden Golan was also booed during her performance. These protesters shared their feelings.
I do like Eurovision. My children are listening to Eurovision and they are living in ignorance and happy about Eurovision. And I would like it to be so that the music will unite people. And we all love music, but this year music is dividing people and I don't like that.
Putting on a show like Eurovision is just feels wrong when these things are happening. So I'm showing my support from Palestine and hope that the countries and the leading people of the countries will react in some way. That's my hope.
Eurovision is normally known for fun, sequins and silliness. I asked our reporter, Charlotte Gallagher, who's in Malmö, if the controversy over Israel was overshadowing the contest.
It is. I mean, it doesn't really feel like a normal Eurovision Song Contest in many ways. Normally, Eurovision is about songs and sequins and incredible performances, but when you're in Malmö, you don't really feel like there's this massive musical party going on. There are hundreds of police visible in police uniforms, and then there's also lots of other plain-clothed police officers walking around, but you can tell they're police because they're wearing earpieces. And there was a huge protest today, as you've heard, in the centre of Malmö. So it does feel incredibly strange. Like, even when we arrived and we went to our hotel, before we could enter the building, we were asked to show that we definitely had a booking by armed police that were outside the hotel. And we don't know if that's because someone is staying there or whether, you know, just security procedures are so tight in Malmö. It does seem very odd. And obviously, this tense situation is going to continue. Now Israel have qualified and they will be competing in the final on Saturday.
So we could possibly see more protests on Saturday. But meanwhile, tell us about some of the other acts tonight.
There really was so much on display. Nemo, the Swiss act, who's incredibly popular, they got through. They've got a sort of operatic act in many ways, and they're kind of balancing almost on the head of a pin while they're dancing around. Austria, their rave song, got through. Georgia got through. Latvia, for the first time in a long time, they've got through to the final. So some real crowd pleasers are going through to the final on Saturday. Lots of people really excited about Ireland in the final. They're already through. They've got Bambi Thug, who describes herself as a witch, and it's kind of Ouija board pop. So there really is kind of something for every taste. You've got rock, you've got rave, you've got opera, and you've got this other kind of whole mix of traditional influences, like Armenia, for example. They're using quite traditional instruments and they're singing in Armenian as well. So there really is something for everyone. As usual, Eurovision is bonkers. I mean, the Finnish song, for example, you've got a guy dancing around in a thong as well. So you've really got a lot going on the night.
Charlotte Gallagher in Malmö. Somalia's government has written to the UN Security Council to say it no longer needs its political mission to the country. And when its current mandate expires in October, it should not be renewed. UNSOM, as the UN mission is called, has been in Somalia for more than a decade, helping the government to build a democracy. It's also overseen a force of peacekeepers from the African Union. But now the government says it can go it alone, which sounds like a positive step. But is it? Rebecca Kesby spoke to Matt Bryden, co-founder and strategic advisor of Sahan Research Organization based in Nairobi.
That's the way that both the federal government and the United Nations are presenting it, that it's a positive development, meaning that Somalia no longer needs a United Nations political mission. On the other hand, the mandate of the political mission has not yet been fulfilled, which was to support Somalia with completing its constitution, setting up a federal system, electoral system for one person, one vote elections in about 2 years' time. And none of that is ready. So there are questions as to whether or not this decision might be premature.
So what is your understanding as to why they're doing this?
Somalia's federal government is feeling a very positive vibe at the moment. It has succeeded in lifting a United Nations arms embargo in Somalia. It has acceded to the East African community, and it has achieved a number of other milestones, debt relief with the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, that look like Somalia is really on the road to recovery. Internally, on the other hand, there are serious challenges, including the fact that about half of Somalia's territory is beyond control of the federal government, because the administrations in those parts of the country don't accept the federal government's rule. And what remains is largely controlled by the extremist group Al-Shabaab.
I think it's still saying that it wants the peacekeepers, which are from the African Union. Just talk us through that decision.
The African Union peace support mission in Somalia used to have about 22,000 troops, and now it is at about 14,000. And it's supposed to draw down to just over 10,000 by the end of June. The problem is that the federal government really doesn't control much beyond the capital Mogadishu and its environs. So it has been relying on African Union troops to extend its authority to other parts of the country. If the African Union draws down to 10,000 troops, it will leave the capital Mogadishu and a number of other major centers exposed to Al-Shabaab, and there is a risk of the federal government not only losing territory, but actually coming under threat from Al-Shabaab.
I mean, is there a situation whereby the Security Council would refuse and say, actually, no, we think we need to stay longer?
In theory, Somalia's federal government is actually a provisional or an interim government. So in one sense, it would be possible for the UN to say that a peace support operation is required and mandated whether the government wants it or not. But that doesn't seem likely to happen. The federal government is asserting sovereignty and the UN seems likely to agree. But if Al-Shabaab were to approach Mogadishu and to threaten the federal government, then this would be a problem for Somalia's neighbors and for the region. And there's also a concern on the part of Somalia's Western partners that maybe it's time for the federal government to negotiate with Al-Shabaab in order to prevent a takeover.
Matt Bryden from the Sahan Research Organization based in Kenya. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has sacked the head of the guards responsible for his personal protection, Serhii Rud, over an alleged assassination plot. Two colonels who worked for Serhii Rud were arrested earlier this week, accused of working for Russia with the aim of killing Mr. Zelensky. Our Ukraine correspondent James Waterhouse reports from Kyiv.
The allegations the two colonels are facing are both lengthy and eye-opening. They include allegedly trying to find close protection officers for President Zelensky and other senior officials who'd be willing to kidnap and kill them. It's claimed they were recruited by Moscow before the full-scale invasion and were caught transporting weapons and explosives to Kyiv for an attack. If Serhii Rud's job wasn't vulnerable enough, another one of his officers at the State Security Service has been charged with murder.
James Waterhouse in Ukraine. There was once a belief that whatever problems the global economy had, you could always rely on China to give it a boost. But Asia's powerhouse hasn't bounced back from the coronavirus as expected. Despite the gloom, though, one bright light has been China's domestic tourism market, which has improved in a dramatic fashion. Some 295 million trips were made there last week during the five-day May Day break. That's up by more than 28% compared to 2019, and that was before the pandemic. However, Beijing is concerned that international travellers haven't returned to China in the same numbers as before, and the government is now introducing measures to woo back foreigners. Our China correspondent Stephen McDonnell reports from Wuzhen in the country's southeast.
Walking down the stone streets of the historic river town Wuzhen, you can see that tourism here is definitely back. And given how slowly China has been recovering from the COVID crisis, this will be a welcome sight. While other parts of the Chinese economy have been flat or even worse, at least with tourism, it's as if the energy has come back. And this has been good news for the local stall holders. For example, one man selling ice cream in the streets.
Tourist numbers lately and not too bad.
Are the numbers as good as before COVID?
Almost the same.
Other shopkeepers echoed this positive sentiment. I asked the woman selling traditional snacks how her business was going.
Business is going well and it will only get better.
Chinese tourists like to dress up in traditional clothing when they visit Wuzhen, as if they'd been really transported back hundreds of years. Those we met said that post-COVID, their friends and family were all embracing travel.
Of course, after the pandemic, we are all visiting other places.
One thing we do notice these days at China's historic sites is a lack of international travellers. In years gone by, you would have expected to see many faces from overseas in places like this. But today, we haven't seen many. And the tourism industry here is asking itself why that might be. We did find some international tourists to ask about this. For example, a young woman from Russia who's studying here, but was visiting Wuzhen with her mother, who's here on a holiday.
It's actually really difficult to have a credit card here, especially for tourists or like for my mom.
So for foreigners who are based here, it's okay, but it becomes more difficult if you're visiting, is that right?
Yeah, it is.
Do you have any suggestions of what would make it more smooth for tourists to come here?
Actually, I think China is still a little bit more of like not so open to foreigners, I think so. China is a really good country, and not only for visiting, also for living here or working here for a long time. But my friends and all the stuff, they actually are living in China because in some things it's really inconvenient because Chinese are not so open for like to you.
And a young Italian couple who just arrived.
Regarding the payments, of course, it can be at the beginning a bit confusing, let's say, but I mean, it's okay, you handle it.
But it's worked smoothly, signing up for the digital payments? It all worked okay, easily? Or?
For now it's easier than last year.
And what would you say, like, if some, you know, foreigners are thinking they might want to travel to China, but they think, oh, it's all a hassle because I don't know how to do all these payments and book tickets and stuff. What would you recommend to
them? To find a Chinese friend, like we did.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So it makes it easier to have a Chinese friend.
Much easier.
They said that in Italy, there hasn't really been a major change regarding, say, political stigma over Chinese human rights abuses or global tensions, which would prevent tourists from coming here, adding that having regular, cheaper air connections would be a more important factor to consider. China has tried to entice more travellers by expanding the number of countries which don't need visas, and many more places allow short stays, visa-free, for those who have onward plane tickets. Yet there remains a significant disparity in terms of the domestic and international tourist numbers. In places like Wuzhen, though, where little stone bridges crisscross rivers as wooden boats ferry visitors up and down, the tourism companies hope that incredible sights like this will eventually be too much for foreign travellers to resist, and that eventually they'll be back either way.
That report by Stephen McDonnell in China. Still to come on the Global News podcast, the Italian military is being deployed to deal with a growing problem.
There's a huge population, 2.3 million all over the country. There have been reports about them encroaching on territory in places like Rome, where they come in and they're going through the bins.
Italy's wild boar population.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're asking, is the clock running out on the U.S. campus protest movement? Weeks of demonstrations and arrests have grabbed headlines, but the school year is winding down. Will students take their protests home or to the polls in November? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. The paranormal, a giant possum, and adult movies. Just some of the subjects that came up in another colourful day in court for Donald Trump. On Thursday, it was the second day of testimony in New York for the porn star Stormy Daniels. She is the figure at the centre of Mr. Trump's hush money trial, which revolves around a six-figure payment made to her before the 2016 presidential election. Mr. Trump has pleaded not guilty to 34 counts of falsifying business records to conceal the payment and denies any sexual encounter with the adult film star. He spoke to reporters as he headed into court.
Here we sit after 2.5 weeks, and I think you'll see some very revealing things today. And I want to thank my lawyers. They've done a very good job, but I'd rather thank them after it's over as opposed to now, because we don't want them to get carried away. There's no case.
But there is huge interest in this case, especially after the sometimes salacious testimony Stormy Daniels gave on Tuesday. More than 200 members of the public had to be turned away on Thursday because the courthouse was full. Neda Torfik, our North America correspondent, told us more.
This was a real attempt by the defense to go after Stormy Daniels' credibility, saying everything from the fact that she had apparently changed her story over time to her being motivated by trying to profit off of Donald Trump, a fake story, as they put it, and profit off of his indictment. But look, it was a real battle of wits on the stand. Stormy Daniels replied with kind of these witty, confident remarks using humor, indignation, really hitting back. So, for example, she was asked about her experience making phony stories about sex appear real as her profession in the adult film industry. And to that, she laughed and said the sex in the films was very much real, just like what happened to me in that room, a reference to that alleged sexual encounter with Donald Trump, which he denies. And, you know, for example, when she was asked about her posts on social media and if she thought her story would be instrumental in putting Donald Trump in jail, she replied, "I don't see the word instrumental or jail." So she really wouldn't be kind of drawn into a lot of the defense questioning and trying to discredit her. She really turned that around. It'll be interesting to see how the jury has related to that.
And it'll be also interesting to see what impact this has on the American public.
That's absolutely right. I mean, we saw on Tuesday such very vivid, explicit details coming out about that alleged sexual encounter. And the defense actually asked for a mistrial after that. Today, again, they say they're going to put another motion for a mistrial that the judge said will be listened to at a hearing on Thursday. But nevertheless, all of this really relates back to how the public and the jury view her story, if she came off as being authentic. And I can tell you from being inside the overflow room watching Stormy Daniels' testimony, her tone, she had a very kind of confident body language. She didn't really allow herself to be intimidated by the defense. So that's also part of the kind of impression jurors will get from her testimony.
Neda Torfik, the co-founder of the law firm at the centre of the Panama Papers tax scandal, has died. Ramon Fonseca Mora was 71 and had been suffering from ill health. Rory Gallimore reports.
The Panama Papers was a leak of millions of financial documents 8 years ago that exposed how some of the world's richest and most powerful people hid their wealth. At the heart of the revelations was a now-defunct law firm, Mossack Fonseca. Last month, nearly 30 of its employees went on trial in Panama, facing money laundering charges. Mr. Fonseca, who denied wrongdoing, was among them. But he didn't appear in court because he was in hospital. A novelist as well as a lawyer, he set up the firm with Jürgen Mossack in the 1970s. Mr. Fonseca once reportedly described the merger as the creation of a monster.
Rory Gallimore. The Italian military is being deployed to cull wild boar. There are more than a million of them roaming freely across the country, and they've long been seen as a nuisance, snuffling through rubbish, rampaging through cultivated fields, or even cornering terrified shoppers. But now cases of swine fever have been found among the boars, and amid fears that the disease could spread to farmed pigs, some countries are restricting imports from Italy, which could have serious consequences for its multi-billion dollar pork industry. Our Europe regional editor, Nikki Cardwell, told us more.
This has become a major problem for them. It's been going on for a while, but up until now, the main problem has been there's a huge population, 2.3 million all over the country. There have been reports about them encroaching on territory in places like Rome, where they come in and they're going through the bins. Occasionally they may attack somebody, but it has been more of an irritant than a problem. What has happened, though, is in recent months, they found three cases of swine fever in wild boar in the Parma region, which of course is synonymous with Parma ham, and this is causing a problem for the industry. Now, they export millions of ham every year with these countries. Originally, it was China, Japan, Korea, saying there was a problem and they weren't going to take imports. It's now Canada that said specifically from that region that they won't take them, and they're concerned about America, which is their biggest market.
But if you're talking about such a huge boar population, it's going to be a huge operation to cull them. How are the army intending to do this?
And it is only a small number of soldiers who are actually going to go out there, but they will have the most up-to-date equipment. They're talking about using drones, and the army will have like night vision goggles. So this isn't going to be like some kind of sport where sports huntsmen do have a hunting season out there for boars anyway. They're going to have top equipment.
When you say drones, you mean drones to spot them rather than
to spot them, yes. They'll have drones that will detect heat patterns, so they will be able to detect where the populations are living. So they will have a fair idea. It won't be like they're just going in and seeing what they can find.
And what's the reaction been in Italy to all this?
There's been very little reaction. It's been a problem for a while, and there's been a lot of political conversations about it and a lot of promises that have never come through. They've tried various tactics. They've tried putting up fences and they've tried protecting the bins and to keep them away from the populace, and it hasn't worked. There have been suggestions that the army should be brought in for a while. It seems that now that the industry is threatened, the government is finally doing something.
Nikki Cardwell. If you vape, you might want to listen closely. Scientists researching liquids used in vaping have found that many of them contain chemicals which pose significant health risks when heated and inhaled. Numerous potentially toxic compounds were found in 180 different vape flavours by scientists who employed artificial intelligence to aid their research. Victoria Uwankunda spoke to the lead author of the report, Professor Donal O'Shea from the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland, who told her more about the key findings.
What we have put together in this particular report is our work that describes the artificial intelligence examination of all 180 flavours that are in vaping products that are currently sold worldwide. And what we're seeing is that an alarming amount of breakdown products can be made just before these chemicals are inhaled into the person's lungs. And because these compounds are known, we can check in databases to see what their toxicities or health hazards warnings are. And that gives us an indication of what diseases may emerge in the vaping population maybe 10, 15 to 20 years from now.
And what are those diseases that could eventually happen to those who vape?
I think most certainly we're looking at things like lung damage, cardiovascular diseases, and potentially cancers as well, because these compounds have been recognised to cause these health impacts already in different studies.
But one will imagine or think that these kind of risks or health impact or implications could have been known before, because we've had people smoking tobacco for years.
I agree. Yes, it seems strange that we seem to be reliving this type of health issue that we should have learned more from the tobacco crisis and the length of time it took us to prove the health damages in terms of cancers and so on caused by tobacco. But we seem to not have remembered all of that, and we have to sort of reinvestigate again and demonstrate that this is the case potentially for vaping as well. Like, there are differences from tobacco smoking because essentially these are chemical entities that our human lungs have never really been widely exposed to before. So there may be differences as well, not all just the same as tobacco. And I guess what we know intuitively is exposure to a wide range of chemicals and their breakdown products in the lungs will lead to potentially to diseases, especially from long-term exposure.
Professor Donal O'Shea from the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland. The tech giant Apple is facing an online backlash over an ad for its new range of iPads. The one-minute video shows a giant hydraulic press crushing books, musical instruments and other creative tools into oblivion. It was meant to illustrate how much Apple has been able to squeeze into its thinner tablet. But a host of artists have criticised the company for what they call cultural insensitivity. The actor Hugh Grant accused the tech giant of destroying the human experience. At the time of recording this podcast, Apple hadn't yet responded to the negative feedback. Roger Hearing spoke to Mark Bukowski, PR and crisis consultant. So what does he think of the advert?
Well, everybody is curious about Apple's advertising. Whenever a new product is dawning, it comes complete framed by a great piece of advertising. And historically, Apple have created some of the world's greatest advertising. You know, it's Apple Mac original ad back in the day is heralded as one of the greatest of all times. So when I saw this commercial sort of take shape, my jaw dropped. I found it astonishing that a brand that was absolutely so close to the cultural zeitgeist now moved into a place which showed just how hubristic and how unattached they were to the very creative community that they have been fueling for decades.
So clearly a misstep. It's not something they calculated and wanted to get some controversy. You reckon this is just a mistake?
I think it's very poor commercial. I think that they haven't taken account for the paranoia that exists through the creative community, particularly about AI at the moment. And the idea of crushing all this creativity into a nice little flat iPad was probably thought to be a great little commercial. Unfortunately, they haven't put it into context.
In a way, they want to sell these things, but they must want to sell them not just to their current community, but more widely. So in that sense, perhaps it does work, because an awful lot more people are watching this and thinking about it than would otherwise have done.
I think people are now considering the Apple brand. It is dealing with a number of court cases around the world at the moment, related to perhaps some of their actions in how they've grown. We look at the big titans of the internet and Silicon Valley at the moment, and we feel uncomfortable about the power that they exert. And for a new iPad that is described as thinner than any other and lighter than any other, one then sort of skews down to that and said, is that all it can do? But I don't think they want to create such controversy within the community that drives their cult-like status.
Is this going to hurt them, though? I mean, is it going to hurt the bottom line, or is it just a storm in a teacup, do you think?
Well, these things tend to be a storm in a teacup, particularly when you've got sort of social media pile-ons. If a brand doesn't learn from its mistakes and carries on regardless, if they don't look at this and think, hang on a minute, you know, let's look at the criticism, let's analyse the criticism, perhaps that's the mistake they'll make. They're a big brand, but they've got a number of challenges that they face at the moment, particularly around copyright, both in a number of products at the moment. And, you know, these things are a bit like water on stone, and they will erode trust, and people will begin to think twice about it. I suspect that Apple will bounce back. This will be perceived to be a misstep, and I'm sure they'll move forward.
Mark Bukowski, PR and crisis consultant. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Nick Randall. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janet Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.